WVYA, 89.7 FM, Williamsport, with translators in Clark Summit at 90.3 and in Bethlehem at 105.7. We're member-supported public radio for northeastern Pennsylvania and the Poconos. WVIA, your vision, your voice. Mostly cloudy today with scattered snow showers, highs in the mid-30s. Tonight, partly cloudy with scattered flurries, lows around 20 degrees. Monday, sunny in the morning, cloudy with scattered snow showers in the afternoon, blustery with highs in the mid-30s. Monday evening, partly cloudy, cold with lows 5 to 10 degrees above zero. Tuesday, partly sunny, cold, highs about 15 to 20 degrees. Currently, in Williamsport, it's 34 degrees, and outside of our studios here at WVIA, it's about 31 degrees. It's 12 noon. What do you say we join Sunday Classics on your arts and information station, WVIA FM.
After Lovey Joe
sold the song and went to Europe.
What year was that about?
Well, the first one over 1910, played the whole continent, clean up into Russia.
How'd they react to ragtime?
Oh, very, very favorable, very favorable. In fact, I had a lot of the counts and discounts and no counts and recounts.
I was teaching them how to play ragtime. They were great piano players themselves, marvelous musicians, you know, but they didn't have that swing. They didn't have the thing nor the swing, see? I had the thing and the swing.
Musician Joe Jordan, in an interview from 1962, provided by Dick Baker, from a recent recording on New World Records, titled From Barrel House to Broadway, the musical odyssey of Joe Jordan, featuring the Paragon Ragtime Orchestra under the direction of Rick Benjamin. An anthology of 20 songs, the very first comprehensive survey of Jordan's remarkable output of over 600 songs in a lifetime that lasted 89 years. Rick Benjamin didn't set out to prepare a pioneering recording on Joe Jordan. He tells us he was doing research on Scott Joplin in the magazines and newspapers of the day, and articles and references to Joe Jordan kept turning up. In fact, Benjamin couldn't seem to avoid Jordan in the press of the time. It wasn't long before the light bulb went off and Benjamin realized Joe Jordan must have been a very important figure, gauging by the amount of ink dedicated to the pianist, composer, songwriter, arranger, conductor, organizer, promoter, and educator. All of this at a time when racial discrimination was rampant. Rick Benjamin tells us Jordan's life and work came together with that of Scott Joplin, James P. Johnson, W.C. Handy, Bill Bojangles Robinson, Ethel Merman, Orson Welles, and many more, as we'll hear. Rick Benjamin paid a visit to the WVYA studio in Williamsport to talk with us about Joe Jordan and to share some of his music.
The first thing everybody needs to know is he was one of, if not the most famous, black musician of the early 1900s. And he inhabited a world that was wonderful and very difficult as well. I mean, he was born in Cincinnati in 1882, and he had very little education, as most people of his race at that time, and ended up living the sort of true life, self-made Horatio Alger story, where he made his opportunity and parlayed that very obscure upbringing with his little violin tucked under his shoulder into status as one of America's first black millionaires.
Was he in a musical family?
Where no, did the didn't music... seem to be. His father was a gentleman named Zachariah, who ran a number of different establishments, but a pool hall at one time. His mother was homemaker, and Joe signaled, showed immense talent in music as a very small child. And he was very impressive to the people around him, and his mother determined that she would find him a teacher to really show him music. And Cincinnati at that time, and still, is a very musical city. And in the 1880s, there were numerous bands. There was a symphony orchestra, many, many German choral societies. And interestingly enough, a lot of music publishing, including classical music publishing, to support all of this. So Mrs. Jordan found Joe and his sister, a music teacher, an elderly German man, who was to teach Joe the violin and his sister the piano. And this worked out well until about lesson six, when the maestro asked young Joe to begin an etude that they had worked on a few weeks ago. And Joe just sort of opened the book and blinked and was unable to start. He held the bow above the instrument but couldn't start. And he couldn't start because he didn't know what note there was on the page. He had been basically doing everything by ear. The teacher had demonstrated this etude, and then Joe had just followed by rote. He just did it by ear, and he wasn't learning how to read. Well, the teacher was enraged. He felt that this was a prank being played on him, and he dragged the kid to his mother and said, he is a cheat and a scoundrel, and I'm not going to teach him. And that was it for Joe's lessons. Now, the German continued with the sister, who dutifully practiced her czerny and, you know, sat there and did her stuff. And Joe sat in the other room and made note of this, and then would play all of her lessons. So he taught himself how to play the piano that way. And he actually did play the violin well enough to play professionally. And he did, at various points in his career, long career, by the way, more than 60 years, support himself playing these various instruments, and became known. The Indianapolis Freeman newspaper called him the best player of all of the instruments of our race. He played the bass and the cornet and the drums, the violin and the piano. And these things, mostly self-taught, were what enabled him to become a brilliant orchestrator, especially for the theater, later on in his life. But he was mainly self-taught.
What happened in Cincinnati that got him out of Cincinnati? How did he get out of
Cincinnati? The family moved eventually to St. Louis, which was a growing city in the Midwest, and probably a more welcoming one to African Americans. Cincinnati has, especially in the 19th century, always had a very troubled racial history. There were a lot of riots and different immigrant groups fighting amongst each other, and it was very turbulent. So when there was an opportunity to get away from that, the Jordan family and many other black families took it and went west to St. Louis, which was still the Wild West at that time. There was a burgeoning district where people of color could have their establishments, their shops, and part of that town was called the Chestnut Valley. That was the black neighborhood in St. Louis, Missouri. And that's where the Jordan family moved. The father opened a pool room there, and Joe sort of wandered around and listened to what was happening. And he was catching the very beginnings of what would be called ragtime music. And at that time, that was an underground black urban folk music. It wasn't written down. It was a sound that you heard in the underworld. You'd go to saloons and pool rooms and things, and you'd hear the professors, flamboyant characters who were artists in their own right, sitting there improvising America's original music, just making it up. And these were the sounds that Joe heard. And more importantly, not far from his father's establishment was another emporium run by a gentleman named Turpin. And his son, Tom Turpin, was one of the hottest of the ragtime pianists in St. Louis in the 1890s. Tom was not only famous for being a virtuoso, and I mean just an astonishing Paderewski-style player, but he had somehow, some way, learned how to read and write musical notation. Now, that was an absolute, that was, you know, off the chart amazing to his contemporaries, because you did everything by ear. So Turpin, in turn, imparted his interest in notation, musical scoring, to Joe Jordan. Joe would be sitting around, you know, sort of running his fingers through sequences on the piano, and Tom would say, well, that's really neat, Joe, but you should write it down, because then you can do it the same way every time, and better yet, other people can too, and if you get published, then they'll give you money. Aha. So Turpin taught Joe about the economic basis of the artist and the publisher and the composer and how all of that worked. And that had to have been an eye-opener for him.
He's there wandering around listening, absorbing. Does he absorb and add something to ragtime?
Yeah, it's pretty obvious that we're talking about now the beginnings of ragtime music, too. I mean, we were getting out of the 1880s, we're in the 1890s now, but this music was still underground and still being developed. Turpin had a place there. He opened his own establishment, which attracted all kinds of players and composers, including Scott Joplin, who used the Rosebud Cafe as a headquarters there. Everybody stood around and listened and traded ideas. So it was an incredibly important environment for the beginning of this music, because these players, some of them stayed in St. Louis forever, but many of them, like Joplin, traveled the country then, spreading this sound with them. But this wasn't enough for Joe. He determined pretty early that he wanted to know more about music.
We're speaking with Rick Benjamin, music director and founder of the Paragon Ragtime Orchestra, about Joe Jordan, in conjunction with the recent release of a groundbreaking album of Jordan's music with the Paragon Ragtime Orchestra on New World Records. Joe Jordan actually went to Lincoln Institute, now Lincoln University, to study music, and then in 1904 made his way to Chicago, where he was drawn to the Pekin Theater, America's first black-owned and managed entertainment center, a very important part of his career, where he learned to do it all in musical theater. Jordan began to travel back and forth between Chicago and New York, and during his stay in 1910, he had, as Benjamin puts it, a meeting with destiny.
He worked in vaudeville. He did so many things that as you read the trade press of that time, you just wonder how one human being could do this, running from theater to theater, taking short tours here and there, becoming involved in the organization of the Clef Club, which was New York City's Black Musicians Union, which was a by invitation thing, too. You just didn't walk down there and join the Clef Club down on 47th Street. You were invited, and then you were auditioned to get in. He was involved with that, all of this hurly-burly of showbiz in New York, and somehow, and no one's clear how this happened, Joe Jordan became involved with the great Florenz Ziegfeld, the producer of Great Note and founder of the Follies, which started in 1907, actually. And somehow, Joe Jordan ended up in a rehearsal hall where the Follies was getting underway in 1910, in the spring. And there was a young girl who Flo Ziegfeld had seen in burlesque. Now, as a little side trip here, you got to remember that burlesque in those days wasn't what it became. If you think of burlesque at all, sort of girly shows. But true burlesque was actually parodies of contemporary stage plays. You know, there'd be a show called The Perils of Pauline, and the parody, the burlesque, would be The Stickiness of Gelatine, you know, starring Weber and Fields. So that was burlesque. And so there was this young girl in burlesque named Fanny Bryce, and she had been seen by Ziegfeld, and he thought, wow, you know, she's got something. We could put her in the Follies. The only problem was the Follies was full of giant, beautiful women that had absolutely no place for this kid, you know. She didn't fit in. She didn't have any material, so she showed up for Follies rehearsal. Sounds like Little League practice, but anyway, she showed up in her uniform for Follies rehearsal and didn't have anything to sing at all. And so she goes over to Mr. Ziegfeld and says, I don't have a song for the show. So he ushered them over to Joe Jordan and Will Marion Cook, who were standing around backstage. Said, these guys will come up with something for you. Well, Jordan and Will Cook looked at each other like, we don't have a song for you, kid. So there are various accounts of what happened. One chronicler, Fanny Bryce's biographer, says that they all went uptown to Fanny's mother's apartment, and Fanny's mother proceeded to bombard them with fine cooking until they relented and decided to write her a song. I understand that's probably not what happened, but in any event, Jordan and Cook together did write a song for Fanny Bryce overnight, and they were ready the next morning with it, brought it in for rehearsal, and Fanny trumped out on the stage there, clomped out, and started to sing this thing. And Joe's at the piano, and she launches into Lovey Joe. Well, this magnetized everybody. Ziegfeld is swaying back and forth. Wow, this is really neat. It's ragtime. The cast got quiet. They stopped their murmuring, and the costumers stopped their cutting. And everybody looked at the stage, and here's this little girl singing this song and, you know, gesticulating wildly. And it was hot stuff. Well, she got to this line, I just cries for mole, more. And Abe Erlanger was in the room. Now, Abraham Lincoln Erlanger was one of the greats, the magnate of American theaters of that time. He was a millionaire. He owned hundreds, if not thousands, of theaters. And he was the money behind the Ziegfeld Follies. Flo Ziegfeld, being great and well-tailored, never had money. But he always had a gift for getting it out of people like Erlanger. Well, Mr. Erlanger, in all his opulence, was sitting there, sprang to his feet and ran up to the stage and said, what was that? What was that line? And the music stopped, and Fanny Bryce stepped forward and said, I just hollers for mo'. And Erlanger puffed himself up and took a cigar out of his mouth and said, for $2.50, you don't say mo', you say more. It's a ticket. The $2.50 ticket was a lot of money to see the Follies. So this began a little argument with this little 17-year-old or 19-year-old kid with this 60-year-old magnate who owns 1,000 theaters about this one lyric, and it got very heated, and Erlanger turned around and said, "That's it, this number is cut from the show. You're out of the Follies." So Fanny ran off the stage. Ziegfeld, seeing these things for a lifetime, just kind of calmly sat there with his unfiltered cigarette going, "All right, we'll fix this later." He went around to Fanny Bryce later and said, "Look, you know, we'll keep the song in. Just will you stop agitating the money? We need this guy, okay? He's the money." So they had a tryout. They went through rehearsals. Fanny Bryce stayed away from the rehearsals until the opening night, and most shows even today open out of town, and the Ziegfeld Follies of 1910 opened in Atlantic City. So that night, Fanny comes out. Now, she's dressed in this urchin's outfit. She's in blackface, which is perfectly acceptable at that time. But she clomps out in this ridiculous outfit, looked like a schoolgirl, many sizes too small dress. Now, after all of these brilliantly beautiful ladies had come sashaying out in the Follies, this was just unbelievably strange. Erlanger was in the wings. The cigar has gone out. It was just apoplectic. He can't believe what's going on here. They're my Follies. She goes out, opens her mouth, starts to sing. Within a few seconds, the audience is swaying. Everybody went berserk for Lovey Joe by Joe Jordan, sung by Fanny Bryce. She was a hit. The place exploded. They wanted her to do it again. She came off stage, and there is Erlanger, who said, "You know, you were right." He actually apologized to her in the wings there of the theater, saying, "You know, this was great." And so that was how Fanny Bryce launched her career, had her career started, and became all of the things that she became over the years. Star of the Follies for decades, she was a star. Of course, went on to many other things in films and in radio. Remember Baby Schnooks, right? Well, Fanny Bryce. And this is how she got started, with a little song by Joe Jordan named Lovey Joe.
And so when you reflect on his life and work and music, what kinds of things come out of an experience like this?
I think the salient point would be Joe Jordan's complete embracing of optimism. He never wrote a sad tune. And just the way he lived his life of opportunity and seeking new experiences and embodying them and making them part of himself and going to foreign lands and learning different languages, writing in different styles, writing his ragtime symphony at the Pekin Theater in 1906. You know, that's lost, by the way. Nobody's seen it, but it's in a program. He was a wide-ranging intellect who really is the vital link between authentic African-American music and the musical theater. Everybody who was writing syncopated music for the stage was an outsider. You know, George M. Cohan writing what he thought was hot ragtime. You know, it's pretty good stuff. But he wasn't in the hood in St. Louis in 1898, where it was really happening. And that's where Joe was unique. He was at the birth of this music, the birth of syncopation in America, and he brought that to Broadway. And showed them really how it was to go, how it sounded. And that's his mark.
Rick Benjamin, music director and founder of the Paragon Ragtime Orchestra, based in Lewisburg, speaking with us at the WVYA studio in Williamsport about the remarkable Joe Jordan in connection with the recent release of a pioneering record titled From Barrel House to Broadway, the musical odyssey of Joe Jordan on New World Records. These, the Beauclair Waltzes, and then we'll hear Lovey Joe on WVIA's Art Scene.
Thank you.
Lovey Joe, music by Joe Jordan, words by Will Marion Cook from The Follies of 1910. Bernadette Burkle joined the Paragon Singers here. We began with the Beauclair Waltzes. This is an album titled From Barrel House to Broadway, the musical odyssey of Joe Jordan, featuring the Paragon Ragtime Orchestra under the direction of Rick Benjamin on WVIA. Programming on WVIA is made possible by our members and by Fidelity Bank, serving Lackawanna and Luzerne counties for over 100 years with full-service trust and investment divisions for your financial assistance. For more information, 800-388-4380 or on the web at bank@fidelity.com.
Hi, I'm Marion McPartland. My guest next time is Canadian pianist John Stetch. His approach to jazz standards.